I do think there is a degree of admiration for a strong man. I'm sorry.
The world is really a dark place when the United States of America is not involved.
You've seen U.S. allies saying that the United States is not a reliable partner.
Welcome to the Global Politico. I'm Susan Glasser, and each week I'll be taking you backstage in a world disrupted. Join us every Monday morning for new episodes. Rate and subscribe to us on iTunes or whatever your preferred podcast platform is. And do email me anytime at sglasser@politico.com. And now, this week's show. Well, fantastic. This is Susan Glasser, and welcome back to the Global Politico. We're here in the Russell Senate Office Building with Senator Tom Cotton, probably one of the leading Republican voices on foreign policy and national security today up on Capitol Hill. And so it's a real treat to talk with him, especially in the middle of what I know he's smiling here, it has been quite a newsy week that he has also found himself in the middle of. He has given a major speech about the Iran deal. It looks like the policy is headed in the direction he suggested it should go. He's also spent a lot of time at the White House this week. So I got to ask you about that, first of all. You went to dinner with President Trump. You were back up there today. What are you two talking about so much?
Well, we had wide-ranging conversations this week, as we normally do, about what is on the Senate's agenda and what's on our country's agenda. But as you say, Iran right now is on the president's mind probably more than anything. He's our commander-in-chief. It's his job to protect this country from threats like Iran. And under the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act, he has to decide by October 15th whether to certify that the Iran nuclear deal is in the United States' vital national security interest and Iran is complying with that deal. So we've spent a lot of time over the last couple of weeks discussing that matter, in addition to things like immigration, with which I've worked closely with the president and his senior team, and taxes, which is, you know, dominating the Senate agenda right now.
So, yeah, that small plate full of issues. But Iran was the subject of your conversation today primarily.
We talked about Iran at some length, yes.
And so, again, this podcast will come out next week. The news will be what it will be. But basically, it looks like President Trump has until October 15th to certify or not to Congress, once again, that Iran is complying with the terms of the deal and that it remains in the U.S. national security interest. You and others have suggested that he not certify it. President Trump himself has made it very clear, including at his speech to the U.N., that he views the deal as, quote unquote, an embarrassment and has run out of patience with recommendations that he should certify it. Is that what's going to happen next week?
I hope so. The president, as you say, at the UN General Assembly made it clear that he believes the Iran deal is an embarrassment, worst deal in history. And in July, the last time the 90-day certification requirement occurred, he made it very clear after that certification that it was a reluctant decision on his part and he wanted more policy options the next time around, which is upon us now. And it's important to note, it's important for your listeners to note, I know this is the Global Politico podcast, that there is a difference between U.S. law and the Iran deal itself. So the certification that is occurring occurs under U.S. law, the Iran Nuclear Agreement Review Act. Every 90 days, the president must certify or not to Congress, not only that Iran is complying with the deal, but also that the deal is in the vital national security interest of the United States. I argued in July, I argue now, that putting aside any questions of compliance, and we can argue those if you'd like, that this deal is manifestly not in our national security interests because it puts Iran on the path to being a lawful, legitimate nuclear power in the second half of the next decade, which is barely 10 years away. Moreover, it empowers Iran through the sanctions relief they've received and through their legitimation in the eyes of the world on their campaign of imperial aggression throughout the Middle East. So in my opinion, it is a straightforward case that this is not in the national security interest of the United States. The president should not certify that it is. That has no immediate impact on the nuclear deal itself. That's another decision that will have to be made by the president and by Congress and by extension, the so-called EU plus three, Britain, France, and Germany.
That's an excellent point. And interestingly, it is a point that is also the point that was made to me last week by Iran's foreign minister on this podcast, Javad Zarif, who negotiated the deal. He also made the point that in some ways, President Trump's speech at the UN was a little bit misleading to people. It sort of implied that he could just walk away from the deal or blow it up. And Zarif's point was, well, this is actually a UN Security Council resolution, and he was sort of staking out a position that in an interesting way, obviously the rhetoric is 100% different, but he's also basically saying this is an internal matter for the Congress. It's up to Congress to adopt any decision or not adopt any decision. In the past, he means during the original approval of the deal, in effect, it was decided not to bring it to the floor as a treaty. Now, I know you had strong issues with that, but basically, I know that your rhetoric is exactly opposite, but it seems to me that the foreign minister of Iran, Zarif, and you, and the emerging policy that we're hearing about is, okay, well, President Trump might decertify the deal, but that doesn't mean that you support blowing it up right away on October 16th. It doesn't mean that you think Congress should go ahead and pass tough new sanctions right away. Right? Am I correct in understanding that?
So Javad Zarif is correct in his description of U.S. law and its relationship to the nuclear deal, but he is incorrect in the path ahead. That certification sends a very important signal to Congress and to our EU plus three partners and to Iran that this president is not going to abide by a disastrous nuclear deal. Now, we don't have to reimpose sanctions immediately. We've had that power all along. There's nothing that any president can do to take that power away from Congress under our Constitution. Likewise, the president has that power. Javad Zarif is right that there were sanctions under UN Security Council resolutions and under U.S. law. The president has the ability, though, through his power in U.S. law and his veto in the Security Council, to reimpose all those sanctions at a stroke. Again, we don't have to do that on October 16th. I think we can give coercive diplomacy a matter of weeks or months to operate. Can't be years. I know it can't be 2025 to 2030, but we have an opportunity, in part because some of our European partners, recognizing that this president is unwilling to accept the deal as written, have started to acknowledge its flaws, something they did not do for the 18 months of the Obama administration after the deal was struck. So the course of action I recommend after declining to certify is step one. Step two, working with Congress, working with the EU plus three and Israel and all of our Arab allies, who probably would be happy if we reimposed all sanctions immediately and new sanctions as well, to lay out the terms that we think are simply unacceptable. Those are the sunset clauses in the 2024 to 2030 timeline, centrifuge research and development, the inspection regime, the omission of their missile testing program, the lack of any kind of calibrated step-by-step penalties other than snapback sanctions.
So basically what you're recommending and where it seems that the policy that they're going to announce next week is going is to not certify but also not immediately jump into a Congress voting on new sanctions thing, but to try to use this moment then to come up with a new negotiating position that doesn't create a rift with Europe, because that's one of the things.
Given the situation we face today, that's, to me, the most sensible course of action. Similar to the situation that George Bush faced in late 2002, early 2003 with the UN Security Council and the trouble that France and Germany was causing him. He went the extra mile because of his relationship with Tony Blair and José María Aznar from Spain, and to keep their countries as part of those coalitions. I think it's worth giving coercive diplomacy a chance for a few weeks or a few months. Again, it can't be years. It's not an October 16 problem. It can be a 2018 problem, but it can't be a 2025 problem.
Do you think most members of the Republican conference here in the Senate will agree with you on that? Have you already been talking in the conference?
Well, every Republican voted against the nuclear deal. Everyone believes that it's a bad deal. And I think if the president takes that course of action, they'll by and large support him.
Mm-hmm. So let me ask you, you framed it. You said it's not in the national security interest, in your view, to certify it at this time. And you said that in your speech the other night. President Trump, as you pointed out, has also said the Iran deal poses a direct national security threat. Just the other day, Jim Mattis, the defense secretary, came to Capitol Hill. He was asked that question directly in testimony by one of your Senate colleagues.
Do you believe it's in our national security interest at the present time to remain in the JCPOA? That's a yes or no question.
Yes, Senator, I do.
How do you square that circle? And, you know, it's also been reported, of course, that Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, has been advocating for continued certification, not because either one of them loved the deal. They've both been very publicly critical of it. But you now have a situation where the president is on the brink of overruling his two top national security leaders.
So I respect Secretary Mattis. On that specific point, I simply disagree with him, in part because of the points I've been making, especially that no one has any good answer for what happens in 2025 to 2030, which is the blink of an eye in the life of a nation. However, Secretary Mattis also said that he could see the case for staying in the deal with the proper changes to the deal, which is kind of the course of action that I am recommending here. At root, though, we don't have secretaries of state and secretaries of defense to make these decisions. We elect a president who's democratically accountable to the American people. And as you know, they say in baseball, the longest 18 inches is the difference between the assistant coach's seat on the bench and the manager's seat, because it's the difference between advising and deciding. Same thing is true at the National Security Council table.
Well, so do you feel like this is a significant moment for President Trump then in choosing to go a different direction than both of these top two figures are recommending?
I think it's an important moment for the country and for trying to set right what the Iran deal made wrong, not just with Iran's nuclear program, but empowering their violence against the United States and our allies and against our interests throughout the Middle East. I can't speak to every decision that Donald Trump has made in which he may have taken one side or the other inside of his National Security Council or disagreed with all of them. I'm not present for those. But ultimately, those are decisions that presidents make.
All right. So help us, because you have spent a lot of time talking to the president and his team. You are a key outside advisor. You've been very supportive. You recommended that he consider General McMaster for the National Security Advisor's job. I'm sure that the listeners of this podcast and I personally, we want your help. Please help us. We want to understand what is going on with the president's foreign policy. It can seem at times very disjointed. The spectacle yesterday of the Secretary of State giving a press conference like that, not explicitly denying that he called the president a moron. Now, we all have tempers, but still, we all recognize this is a pretty unusual situation. What's going on in your view? Are we still going to have this Secretary of State a month from now?
Well, I'm obviously not privy to the private conversations that the president has with his cabinet members, that those cabinet members have in between themselves. So I can't comment on those news reports that both Rex Tillerson and President Trump have said that they're not accurate. I simply can't comment one way or the other. On your broader point, though, about the president's foreign policy, I would submit that his foreign policy over these first 9 months in office is much more in keeping with a bipartisan tradition of foreign policy, starting with Truman in 1945 and going through George Bush in 2009, than President Obama's policy was. In almost every area, in his own way, with his own rhetoric, he has reasserted American leadership, and he's willing to confront threats before they gather. Again, to go back to Iran, that's my main case why it's not in our national security interest, is that time is on their side, as is usually the case with weaker but aggressive revisionist powers. They grow stronger the longer we let the danger gather. Their economy grows. We have Western corporations that get entrenched in the economy, creating a pro-Iran lobby in our countries. They get more conventional military strength, especially once the arms embargo expires under the deal in 2020, and they ultimately get a nuclear weapon. President Trump realizes those things. That's one reason why I hope that he will decline to certify and strengthen the deal. He recognized that with North Korea. He recognizes that the North Korea present could be the Iran future. He also recognizes in the Middle East that, you know, we had thrown a lot of our allies under the bus over the last 8 years, something that did not happen for many decades beforehand. So even though his rhetoric may sound unusual to the foreign policy establishment in Washington and New York and Brussels, I think his foreign policy itself is much more in keeping with a long bipartisan tradition than Barack Obama's was.
My guess is that even in Little Rock, it's unusual to have the president of the United States threaten fire and fury upon another nuclear-armed nation. But I take your point.
President Reagan once said that the bombing will begin in 5 minutes about the Soviet Union.
Well, he was joking. He was caught on tape joking about that. It's not a very well-received joke, that's for sure.
Well, a broader political point is that Republican presidents are rarely well-received in Europe. I mean, everyone looks back on Ronald Reagan now and agrees that he was one of the two great presidents, along with FDR, of the 20th century, and it was his policies that brought the Cold War to an end. Sometimes they forget about the kind of mass hysteria that was caused in 1983 by the deployment of intermediate-range nuclear forces to Europe, or his speech to Parliament, or his speech at the Berlin Wall, and so on and so forth, leaders of our European allies and their peoples were not very enthusiastic about a lot of those decisions at the time. George Bush faced the same thing in Europe. Now Donald Trump faces it.
Well, some people would say, and that, you know, again, this is not just a Senator Cotton theory of the case. There's certainly plenty of people who believe that if you can somehow screen out the Twitter feed or the rhetoric, that President Trump has had a much more conventionally Republican foreign policy than he's often given credit for. Does that mean you advise people to ignore the Twitter feed? I mean, many people feel
I don't think anyone in the United States or in the world can ignore anything the President of the United States says in any medium. So I think it's important that we heed everything he says. Now, sometimes it has more impact on the state of the world, or it has more impact on a farmer or a waitress or a truck driver in Arkansas, you know, when he's talking about economic matters or security matters, when he's talking about the fake news media. He may be right about that, but it doesn't have the immediate impact on the prosperity and security of the American people.
Just on the sort of national security team and how you see it working. I mean, I all smiling about Twitter aside, I'm actually really interested in your opinion about, you know, it's clearly been reported to be a challenging thing for this establishment. You can bash it all you want, but those are the people, you know, who are running it. You're very familiar with the culture of generals and how different that is from the management style of the president. How is General McMaster doing? How would you describe the system as it's working now? Has it changed since General Kelly has come in?
I think it's changed for the better on two occasions, when H.R. McMaster was selected in late February, and then when John Kelly moved from DHS to the White House in late July. I can see that from where I sit and the kind of interactions we have with the White House and my office before and after both of those. So I think it's continued to improve, as is often the case in the first year of a presidency. I mean, we often forget, because he, you know, won a re-election, how disastrous Bill Clinton's first term was, not just on a policy front, but from an organizational and management standpoint.
And they would acknowledge that in many ways.
And it's a hard job. I mean, running the White House, being president or being chief of staff are hard jobs. I think John Kelly would tell you that if he was doing this podcast. But it's also a very critical job. And people like John Kelly and H.R. McMaster are esteemed and admired for their battlefield exploits. You know, H.R. McMaster fired one of the first shots of the first Gulf War. He was one of the very first regimental commanders to conduct a proto counterinsurgency campaign in Talafer in 2005 in Iraq. However, in the military, at any point above the company level, when you're in command, you by definition have been a staff officer for a commander at that level beforehand. So while we think of people like John Kelly and H.R. McMaster as commanders, that's how they became famous. Remember, they have had regular opportunities to be staff officers for a principal as well. And I think that serves both of them very well. Second, military officers are very well trained in the chain of command. They understand that they're not the president. Donald Trump is the president. Their job is to advise. His job is to decide. Their job is to make sure he has the best facts, the best thinking, presented to him in an orderly fashion and ready for decision. But that he decides, and then they move out and execute.
But basically you're saying that it's a much better organization. Do you see a substantive change as well, or a policy outcome?
You could take the Afghanistan policymaking process and the result, and you don't have to take my word for it. You can take President Trump's word for it. When he gave a speech at Fort Myer last month and announced it, he said it wasn't in his initial instincts to stay the course in Afghanistan with some additional troops. I don't think that surprises anyone based on some of the public statements he has made. I think that was the right course of action. He discussed it with me, and I suggested that he should do something along those lines. That's the way the policymaking process should work. When you're a cabinet member, when you're a senior advisor in the White House, and the president is right, you should help him achieve his objectives and run with his thinking. When you think the president is wrong, you have a duty to try to present to him the best facts and the best thinking to help him see it in a different light. And maybe you can, but if he doesn't, and he says, no, I want to do it my way, then your job is to move out and execute. And if you feel strongly enough, then you have to resign.
Do you see that happening with any of these folks?
I don't see it happen. I don't see it being imminent. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can. There are plenty of things in which I can imagine the president making a decision that with which I would disagree, but don't rise to the level of a resignation for any of these men and women who serve him.
Right, especially having already made the decision to work in the administration. There
yes.
are clearly some people who might hold very similar views to you, your views on foreign policy, who probably decided not to work in the administration because they differ with the president's public statements on some of those issues. Senator Corker yesterday made a comment that a lot of people are wondering what it means when he said that Secretary Tillerson and Secretary Mattis are the ones holding the world back from chaos. He feels that Secretary Tillerson hasn't always been supported. And interestingly, when I interviewed Senator Corker for this podcast very early on, he said that he was the first person to offer me, in essence, the Trump can and will evolve on foreign policy theory of the case. So it's not that Senator Corker has always said, no, President Trump will never agree with us, but clearly views this as a serious challenge when the president is not on the same page with these top advisors. Do you think that's a consensus view in the Senate? What do you think he meant by that?
I can't speak for a consensus view in the Senate or what Senator Corker thinks. I will say that my view of what holds the world back from chaos is American military, diplomatic, financial, economic might, in particular the military. It's the soldier, sailor, airman, marine who's out on the front lines around the world that is keeping the world safe and orderly for the American people and has done so for 70 years. The president, like all presidents, comes to office. I think he is exposed to new information, especially classified information, and may see things in a slightly different light. Again, he admitted as much on the Afghanistan question. There may be other examples, but that's not unusual. Presidential candidates don't get much classified information. You know, the cable news always makes a big deal when they go in for
the briefing,
the Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton or Mitt Romney or what have you. But I can tell you that information is not much more than you could read in the international pages of newspapers. It's certainly not the level of information we see on the Intelligence Committee or that a president would begin to see in the presidential daily brief. And some of that information can be eye-opening, especially about particular threats that we faced from adversarial powers around the world. I tend to think that when presidents run for election and they get elected, they believe that the American people elected them based on the agenda on which they campaign, and they want to implement that.
You mentioned the Intelligence Committee. Obviously, there are the ongoing investigations of Russia and its intervention in the 2016 campaign and whether there was any collusion. The Intelligence Committee leaders just came out and said they agree now, having conducted, I believe, 100 interviews, that they agree with the finding of the intelligence community of the United States that Russia was the one who did it, and on behalf of President Trump, now President Trump. Do you share that conclusion? And this is something where President Trump has not seemed to change his view based on new information.
I have no reason to doubt the conclusions of the January intelligence community assessment that Russia hacked into those emails and released them. And it's now coming to light, in part as a result of our inquiry, that they may have had some accounts on social media, Twitter, Facebook, Google, and so forth. I don't think we know the extent of that or if it had any genuine influence, but we're going to have hearings on that later this month in early November. I think there's still one open question, in my mind at least, about that assessment, and that's taking the leap to say not only did Russia, Vladimir Putin in particular, want to sow chaos and disorder in the United States, of course he did. That's what Russia does. They do it in Europe all the time, too. And they wanted to hurt Hillary Clinton, wanted to do it personally because of what Vladimir Putin viewed as slights by Hillary and Bill Clinton over the years, but also wanted to undermine her because they expected that she would be the next president, but also that they wanted to help elect Donald Trump. I think there's at least an open question there, not based on classified information, but just based on the campaigns the two candidates ran. Donald Trump wanted to increase defense spending. Hillary Clinton didn't do so as much. Donald Trump wanted to accelerate nuclear modernization, not so with Hillary Clinton. Donald Trump wanted to expand ballistic missile defense, not so with Hillary Clinton. Donald Trump wanted to pump more American oil and gas. Hillary Clinton did not. All those things don't look good if you sit in the Kremlin. So I at least still have an open question of why Vladimir Putin would want to try to interfere in an election to elect a candidate that was going to pursue policies that is not in Russia's objective interest. May be the case.
Well, he also said that NATO was obsolete and also said that Putin was a very strong and admirable
leader. But the result of his rhetoric about NATO is what?
Right.
NATO now has more troops stationed on a closer proximity to Russia's borders or satellites, and NATO's budget is going up. Again, not in Russia's interest.
Do you think that Donald Trump has changed his mind about Putin just on a personal level? He has been admiring of him.
I've never discussed Vladimir Putin with Donald Trump. But Vladimir Putin is not an ally of the United States. He's an adversary of the United States. He made great gains in the Obama era because Barack Obama, like presidents before him, consistently misunderstood Vladimir Putin and underestimated his ambitions in Europe and in the world against the United States. One of the reasons why Vladimir Putin probably thought he could hack those emails and release them or probe state election systems is because for 8 years, Barack Obama had consistently looked the other way, to the point of mocking Mitt Romney's assertion that Vladimir Putin and Russia was our number one geopolitical foe.
Do you think we've done enough to respond to the Russian hacking? Do you feel that American voting institutions are still at risk?
Well, it's a very important point, and I hope that your podcast is heard by governors and state legislators and secretaries of state, that this is still a live threat. You know, we're just a few weeks away from elections in New Jersey and Maryland. I think primaries for the 2018 midterms begin in March of next year. These state governors, legislators, secretaries of state need to understand that if their voting systems are connected to the internet and they don't have an audible paper trail, that what did not happen in 2016 could happen in 2018, which is to say the actual impact on tabulated votes. No evidence that happened in 2016. But could happen, and certainly don't want that to happen. So I would advise every state, like I've advised my own state, to take very seriously this threat.
Well, it's interesting. I've asked a number of people that, and they feel that there's been a lot of talking about the hacking of 2016, but not a lot of policy movement or new measures.
So most our elections under the Constitution typically are governed at the state or even the local level. We now see that is actually a pretty effective means against these kinds of attacks. If all that data was centralized at a election board in Washington, D.C., and all those elections were administered by the federal government, it would be that much easier to affect them because you only have one system and it's all centralized. In a way, it's kind of like some of our critical infrastructure, electrical power plants, nuclear power plants, very old. They're not digital, they're analog, not connected in any way to the internet. For a long time, people complained about that. Turns out that actually it's a pretty effective defense against cyber attack to have these very old systems that are still operating perfectly well to not be connected, to not be on the so-called Internet of Things. I'm not familiar with every single voting system that's used in the United States, for instance, but I can tell you any state that uses a voting system that is connected to the Internet needs to have an auditable paper trail of that system. And you might even want to go back to the old-fashioned system of just counting up paper ballots.
Have paper ballots.
I think some jurisdictions are starting to consider that.
By the way, in D.C., there's always such long lines. I think almost the only times I've ever voted here, I've just ended up with a paper ballot because that's the only way to get out of the line. Let's go back to the world for a second. You mentioned Russia. We've only briefly touched on North Korea so far, and really only in relation to Iran. Interestingly, you made the argument, I've heard other conservatives make the argument for decertifying on the basis of, if not, we could have another nuclear-armed North Korea on our hands. Of course, opponents of blowing up the deal also use North Korea as an example right now, and they also say, well, listen, we have one crisis on our hands. Why should we have a second? Is it a crisis with North Korea? How serious is it? Is there a risk of a nuclear confrontation?
So first, the opponents are wrong, and I'm right. North Korea doesn't need any excuse to violate its international commitments. In fact, it seems to only make international commitments for the very purpose of violating them. Second, A nuclear North Korea cannot hold a candle to a nuclear Iran. North Korea is a small and isolated country on the edge of the world. It's poor in resources. It's surrounded by four powers that are infinitely larger, richer, and more powerful than it. It does not have a revolutionary ideology it tries to export. Iran, by contrast, on every one of those measures, is in the center of civilization. It's surrounded by nation states of close to equal size and power that compete with it regularly. It has a large and growing economy that has a very essential export, oil, in addition to a revolutionary ideology it tries to export. So however dangerous nuclear North Korea is, nuclear Iran is so much more dangerous. That's why we can't allow it. Now, North Korea. I tend to have a somewhat different view than the conventional wisdom in Washington. I don't think that North Korea will give up its nuclear weapons in response to economic pressure from the United States. That doesn't mean we shouldn't try. We shouldn't throw the kitchen sink at them, which we have not yet done. I think they might in response to economic pressure from China. However, I disagree with the conventional view that China wants a denuclearized North Korea. I don't believe that. I believe China wants a nuclear North Korea. China purports to worry about refugees from a Second Korean War. They purport to worry about a pro-American unified Korean peninsula. There are easy solutions for that. First, for refugees, we may not be able to build a wall on our border, but I'm pretty sure the Chinese Communist Party can. And if they can't, they've got 50 cals and tanks to back them up, which is what they used at Tiananmen Square on their own people. They'll use them on North Koreans. But second, there are numerous diplomatic agreements that we could reach with China if they truly wanted to denuclearize the Korean Peninsula. They're worried about a unified pro-American peninsula? Fine. Like we did with Germany, we can agree that there'll be no forcible reunification. Worried about the positioning of American troops? Fine. We can agree in advance, no troops north of the current DMZ. Worried about refugees? Fine. We can agree to have refugee camps on Korean territory that are supported by the United States and the United Nations High Commissioner on Refugees. They don't do any of those things, nor do they put true pressure on China like banning oil exports to China. Why is that? Because I think they want a nuclear North Korea. And why do they want a nuclear North Korea? Because you just asked me about that. You didn't ask me about the South China Sea. You didn't ask me about their near diplomatic embargo against Taiwan. You didn't ask me about their economic espionage against the United States. They know that as long as North Korea is nuclear, then it will tie down the attention and the resources and the effort and the time of U.S. leadership.
Well, arguably, though, we might have been playing into that argument by getting in a fight over Rocket Man or Little Rocket Man. I guess that's his new name.
I think it's important that the leadership in China understands that President Trump is not going to tolerate a nuclear North Korea in the long run. He's certainly not going to tolerate China continuing to support North Korea's economy, which has grown this year at a fairly robust pace when all these sanctions are supposedly biting and Xi Jinping is supposedly fed up with Kim Jong-un.
No, it really is striking. I did go back and look at some of the arguments back in the first or the second George W. Bush administration over North Korea. And, you know, the argument then was, well, this is the most heavily sanctioned country in the world. So I know we're about to get the hook, but I want to finish up on the politics of foreign policy up here on Capitol Hill. And just quickly, you know, this president, we talked a bit about what's going on inside the administration, but clearly there's also been, you know, a lot of questions about his ability to work to get things done with Republicans up here on Capitol Hill. And there has been, you know, a public war of words between Senator McConnell, your leader, and the president. How lasting a challenge or a problem is that? Most senators, many of them, came to Senator McConnell's public defense. What is a consequence of that now?
I don't think that's lasting. Mitch McConnell and Donald Trump have been around the block once or twice. They're big
boys. Smile on the face here for the podcast audience.
They're big boys, and they understand that the success for one depends in no small part on the success for the other. Look, I'm frustrated, as is Senator McConnell, with the level of obstruction we've seen from the Democrats. We consistently have to have multiple procedural votes spread over multiple days to confirm relatively low-level officials or judges by votes in the 80s and 90s. The Democrats are completely dug in on things like taxes and on health care. So it can be frustrating around here. I understand the president's position, and Senator McConnell does as well. To the extent that the president has a problem with Senate Republicans, I'd say it's more of a membership problem than a leadership problem. But ultimately, President Trump, Senator McConnell recognize that the success of one depends in no small part on the success of the other. And look, the founding fathers gave us, you know, 2-year Congresses, 2-year terms in the House, 6-year terms in the Senate for a reason. We're not judged and evaluated after 9 months in office, after 2 years in office, and we got a long time left in this Congress.
Do you think that based on your conversations with the folks in the White House that there will be more Chuck and Nancy deals, or was that a plot line we've moved on from?
I can't predict the future, but I think that will be relatively rare. That was an unusual circumstance in a debate about both the government funding legislation and the debt ceiling, which was up against a hurricane relief package when you still had people who were depending on all of us, their fellow citizens, through our government to provide them for food and shelter and water and diapers and formula for their kids. I'm not aware of any situation in which a hurricane relief package, which was needed, would have implicated the debt ceiling. I think the president recognized that the likely outcome, if we waited, you know, until September 29th, would have been something like the deal he ultimately reached, and therefore better just to do it on the front end and get 3 more weeks of time to work on the rest of our agenda, on our budget, on taxes, and so forth.
Can I just ask you, because one thing that regular people, even, you know, regular journalists, I might say, find it a little bit surprising that there would be such an uproar at the mere thought of the president of the United States working with the Democratic leadership. You know, that is actually how President Reagan got things done. It seems like things are so partisan here that, you know, this was greeted, and we're not making this up, you know, this was greeted as anathema by many of your colleagues here, your Republican colleagues.
I don't see it as anathema, and I think it would be a good thing, as it always is, if we can have more bipartisan support for our legislation. But the premise of your question, of the concept in Washington of the so-called Chuck and Nancy deal,
right,
is that the president is throwing the keys to the agenda to the Democratic leadership and only getting a few Republican votes. That was not factually the case on that legislation, nor do I think many the people that voted for the president expect him to work primarily with Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi. They expect him to work with the Republicans that they elected to Congress to control the agenda. Obviously, we need Democratic votes as well on lots of legislation and lots of these nominees, and we get them. I wish we got them more often, but we get them. But that's the kind. I mean, traditionally, that's the kind of cooperation you get. When Ronald Reagan was passing major defense buildups, major tax reform, he wasn't getting the votes of the Democratic leaderships in the two chambers. He was getting the votes of the rank-and-file Democrats who recognized that it was in the best interest of their country, in the country, and also in their political interests back home.
We can all say we're not in the 1980s anymore. So you're a big reader. Just final advice to our listeners. What book should we read to understand President Trump and his foreign policy?
I would read Walter Russell Mead's foundational work, Special Providence. Came out 16 years ago. Amazingly, it came out 2 weeks before the 9/11 attacks in 2001, and it has withstood all that's happened in the world since then. And the reason I say you should read that, not only is it an excellent history of American foreign policy, which has a long, noble, and amazing set of accomplishments behind it, the most successful foreign policy in the history of the world, obviously. We went from being 13 backwater colonies to being the most powerful country the world has ever known. But Walter also goes into great detail about the American political tradition, dividing it up into 4 schools of thought, as he says, the more globalist, internationally oriented, outward-focused Hamiltonians and Wilsonians, the somewhat inward-looking, you know, more of the break-on-the-car Jeffersonians, but most importantly for our purposes, the Jacksonians, who probably make up the biggest number of voters across the country, especially the voters in the president's coalition. And, you know, 20 years ago when Walter first started researching this question, I think he had insights that have stood the test of time because these are deeply embedded cultural schools in our politics and our society. So your listeners would learn a lot, not just about the glorious history of American foreign policy, but also the Jacksonian mindset that a lot of people who live in Washington and New York don't often come into come into contact with.
Here's a fun footnote, because that is a terrific and insightful book. When I was the editor of Foreign Policy magazine, I had Walter Russell Mead write a cover story for me. Is the beginning of President Obama's, like, maybe a year or two in his presidency, and he compared. He said Obama is actually like Jimmy Carter in terms of foreign policy schools of thought, that they're unusual, actually, somewhat. They're sort of idealistic but realists, and that's a very unusual, very minority foreign policy view. Well, guess who I got the angry letter to the editor from? And this was pretty inflammatory at the time. It was a cover showing Carter and Obama.
But Jimmy Carter.
That's correct. That's correct. I got an angry letter to the editor
from
Jimmy Carter.
He saw what was coming over the next 8 years, and he didn't want to be compared to Barack Obama. Now, if you look, you know, for 8 years, in some ways, Barack Obama's policy, not just foreign policy but domestic policy, was essentially trying to eliminate the Jacksonian influence on American life. And the Jacksonian school of thought came back with a vengeance in 2016. And President Trump, I think, understood that when he was running for office, and he still understands it to this day. Remember, the Jacksonians are the ones who power this country. They may not sit on the Council on Foreign Relations Board. They may not speak at economic clubs in New York and Chicago, but they are the ones who have worked in our factories for years, who've grown our food, who've driven it to our table, who fight the wars that people in Washington begin. The Jacksonians are the ones who have powered this country, and without them, it's very hard to accomplish much.
Senator Tom Cotton, if there's an opening, would you serve in President Trump's administration?
I'm very happy to be serving in the Senate right now and the people of Arkansas, and it gives me more time for my two little boys than I would have if I was serving in the administration. So I'm pleased that people of Arkansas have trusted me with this position, and I hope they will again.
It is not a categorical denial, for the record there, but I thank you, Senator Cotton, very much for spending this time with us. I think it's a very timely conversation, and of course, we thank all of our listeners at the Global Politico. We hope that you'll listen to us on iTunes or whatever's your favorite podcast platform, and of course, you can email me anytime at sglasser@politico.com. Thank you, Senator.
Thank you.